There were lots of questions, people trying to answer while Herman was talking. So there's one hand popping up in the back here, so we'll take you first, and then you know, go on from there.
Sir and Madame, this is a new idea for making a diet, because you found both. This is 2,500 is a normal annual four-minute ratio of per day for all humans, and we must diminish less than 2,500. And of course, all dieticians, up to like in New York, and Kevin Trudeau, who was sent to prison for this, that he's an easy diet, and there was 1,500. Yet, and a Cambodia Carcinia is much increased for a girl. Yes, now is diminished to the number of calories per day. And of course, what, because you propose increase, like some beer or something, this ratio there was 5,800. Isn't it better diminish the number of calories per day? And because this will be slower and better will be for evolution of brain, you will have more time for thinking.
Do you want to answer that?
Sure. I think that if the goal is to have a lot of time to think, then a slow metabolic rate maybe could be good, because then you live a long time, and there's lots of time to you know, come to these sorts of talks and mull it over.
Are you okay?
I want to raise two questions. One is fairly simple, trivial. The other is more important. The simple one is the capacity to control the rate of energy drain. And here I want to raise two things. One is, a human being, if they can keep a deer in sight on an open plain, on a grass plain, can run a deer down so the deer drops of exhaustion and they can catch it barehanded, as it were. Secondly, some research I did 30 years or so ago on women, on hunter-gatherer societies where they prohibit essentially sex for 2 or 3 years after a baby is born, because women nurse for several years to keep babies from dying with diarrhea in simple societies. If a woman nurses and is pregnant, so she has a child who's pregnant and is herself nursing, one of the three of them is going to die if she gets pregnant. So in other words, people actively control the expenditure of energy, either physiologically as with two-legged running or socially. The second thing is to question you about the unit of energy. One of the things that happens in the evolution from primates to modern humans is that the infant gets increasingly and seriously more dependent because of the way the pelvis changes with upright posture and the size of the brain, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That contradiction between upright posture and larger brains is resolved by having children be incredibly more dependent. So a kid is 8 years old before it can be trusted to feed itself. So the unit of energy expenditure in human societies is not the individual, but the cooperative.
I'll jump in there. That's a fantastic set of points. I don't see a conflict between that sort of framing of it and this. I would just say that. I don't think I would disagree. I would say that. You talked about the element of the unit of energy expenditure being the group, not the individual. That's definitely the level at which energy comes in. The energy is still spent individually, right? So it has to be, right? Because you need to spend your calories a day just like I need to spend mine.
But you pass some of the burden off to my wife?
Here's the thing. That's just it. That's just it. They all share the burden, and they still spend the same number of calories as you do, and I don't know how much you share with your wife, but, you know, it wouldn't matter because you spend the same number of calories every day as a Hadza does. So that's the one thing. I don't think that the unit of analysis sort of is a flaw here. I think humans are very weird in that we forage as a group, forage for food as a group. We, of course, eat it individually. If humans do have a higher metabolic rate, that raises the question, how did that evolve? And why doesn't it evolve in other animals? And one of the reasons that higher metabolic rates probably don't evolve in a lot of species is that you put yourself at risk. If you need 2,000 calories a day, then you have to get 2,000 calories a day. If that's an increase, then that's not only an increase in energy throughput, it's also an increase in risk. Humans buffer that risk and mitigate that risk in a couple of different ways. One is we have body fat more than other primates do. Another way that we buffer it is by exactly what you're saying. Women share with each other and men share with women. Men and women share food at the end of the day. And so if you go hungry, if you struck out today, I share with you. If I strike out tomorrow, you share with me. And so you mitigate risk by sharing. And so what that would suggest is that food sharing is critically important, obviously culturally, but also physiologically, for the reasons you're talking about. And that this human adaptation of a higher metabolic rate, which I think those data, we'll see if they stand up, but I think they will, this big sort of change in metabolic rate, which lets you have a bigger brain, which lets you have a whole lot of, I think, a lot of human unique things, is maybe predicated on a behavioral change to food sharing and the kind of, you know, what we take for granted, which is that humans all share food. None of the apes share food like we do. That's a unique thing. That's not just cultural and behavioral. It's also, I think, critically physiological. About the running thing, humans can run down a kudu. There's a couple of reasons for that. It's not just because we're spending more calories than they are. In fact, the calorie expenditure the reason that you fall over dead isn't because you spent too many calories. It's because you've fatigued your muscles to where they don't work anymore, either because you've overheated or because you've run out of glycogen. And that's how we run those animals to death, not by expending more calories than they do, but by packing our muscles with mitochondria, packing our muscles and livers with glycogen, and having this super efficient sweating mechanism that we can run them till they overheat, and they can't run and pant at the same time, so they overheat and fall over. We're still standing. So obviously it's going to be integrated into this, but it's a different piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, the first question may go into this a little bit. As far as, can you talk about the movement as far as reduced calories, diet, with additional longevity increases in mice, and you know, also humans. And also, you talked as far as throughput being the key differential. So throughput, there's two portions. There's the input, right, and then there's also the output.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if you look at like meditation, things of that nature, that can reduce metabolic rates. That may have any effect on longevity and longevity. Is that something we see in those, or let's say yogis and stuff like that? I mean, it's pure conjecture.
Yeah, it certainly hasn't been, but that makes me think that we ought to do a doubly labeled water study on yogis and see if they can really get their metabolic rates down long term. Surely while they're meditating, I would imagine that they're low. Does the body then go, okay, I'm not meditating now, let's take care of all this business that we were putting off until I was done meditating? That's possible, because we know the body does these sort of, you know, it deals with running after a gazelle right now by tomorrow kind of shutting you down and dealing with the tissue regrowth and all the stuff that you need to do to repair. Anyway, point is, it could all wash out, but it would be worth testing. Are the calorie reduction studies and that show longevity gains in mice and monkeys due to this metabolic damage accumulation? I would argue that's probably one of the mechanisms. There are other things that happen when you starve yourself and your body says, oh, let's put the brakes on a couple of things. But one of the things it puts the brakes on is like inflammation response. And one of the reasons your arteries harden is that every time you eat a really big meal or get an infection, whatever, you get you just sort of low-level inflammation throughout your whole body. maybe that's happening less if you reduce food intake. I don't know if that answers your question, but it's, I think it could be part of it. Yeah.
Following up on your discussion from Jerry Sutter's point, with the larger brain size, and looking at a correlation between a larger brain size making it possible to be much more to just even share food.
Mm-hmm.
Different strategies of doing that, taking the initiative to do that, and so forth. It's kind of saying, it gives a more of like a physical reason for having a brain, rather than that you can actually be thinking of, that you're using the larger brain to do more efficient food for the social unit. So if we progress that, back, does that match up with the 2.5 million years, beginning of a larger brain?
Yeah, well, the paper that Leslie referenced, which is a classic that is sort of required reading for anybody in human evolution, argued just that point, that the evolution of bigger brains is tied directly to a change in diet that you can see in the fossil record. So around 2 million years ago, when we see this increase in body size, in brain size, we see it associated with the advent of stone tools. We see it associated with archaeological sites that have cut marks on the bones of food animals. And so what Leslie and Pete Wheeler argued was that that switch in diet allowed us to have smaller guts and bigger brains. I think this maybe expands that argument out and says another factor here, potentially, is that if you're eating big game, well, you're probably sharing big game because you can't eat a zebra yourself, right? If you're hunting big game without bows and arrows, you're doing it in a group. Maybe you're sharing that food in a larger social group that therefore, knowing who you shared with yesterday and who shared with you and who wasn't very good and who was, maybe those things are actually really become really important for a lot of reasons and become this extra push for a larger brain. Because, it isn't just automatic that a bigger brain would be selected for. There has to be a reason that it's a good idea. And so I think that I think it does jive with the fossil record, because I think what I would predict is that this increase in metabolic rate and this sort of metabolic change we see in humans would probably be mapped onto that change in foraging behavior. Do you want to add anything to that?
No.
Yeah. Did you ask water consumption? Is it positively correlated? On the broad scheme of things, yes. Mice have less water intake and less food intake. Elephants have more water intake, but that's a really kind of facile answer. On a smaller scale, not necessarily. Not necessarily. You were next, I think.
I just want to raise the question about the pod cell.
Uh-huh.
The way you speak about them as being isolated.
Oh, I didn't ever say they were isolated.
Traditional.
Yes, they're traditional for sure.
Traditional.
Yeah.
And my question is, certainly it's been studied.
Oh, yeah.
My question is, what kind of influences food.
Sure.
From the outside.
Yeah.
And so on, might have impacted them. I guess I would caution you against using the term traditional. I think any of cultural people would.
Fair enough. Is there a preferred word? I'd love to know if there's another word that gets that you know what I'm talking about when I say it, and that is a safer word to use. I'd love to hear it, because I am very. Anybody who works with them is, of course, very aware of how integrated they are into the larger fabric there. Yeah, right. It's like the nuclear family is a husband, wife, and an anthropologist, right? So we're all very aware of that. And, The reason I use the word traditional, and again, I'm happy to be educated on a better word to use, is just the fact that they are integrated. And so if you go into some Hadza camps, have a small plot of maize that they farm. Some Hadza camps hardly ever forage for their own food at all. they, tourists come and visit their camps, pay them cash. That has a whole other set of consequences that aren't all good. And, you know, these are just like any other population. There's to talk about them as though they're one category type is obviously problematic. That's why I wanted to make the point that we worked in camps that, you know, their lifestyle in those camps, and again, I'm happy to find a different word than traditional, but is, well, I'll just describe the lifestyle. They wake up in the morning, they forage for food from wild food sources, and that's the food they eat every day. And they do it with technologies that we know from both their oral history and from the archaeological record are ancient. So that's what I mean by that. I don't mean to suggest they're stuck in amber. I hope I didn't give that implication. I didn't imply that. I don't mean it. If I did, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Thanks for the question. One of the things that I
lacking. One of the things that are lacking. Yeah. So the question was that he raised the issue that I didn't include here. He's quite right. Oh no, it's a fantastic question. It's a fantastic question, and it is what I've talked about lifestyle here as a factor or not affecting obesity. But what about genetics and genetic differences between populations? The short answer is, surely it plays a role, and we just don't know right now how big of a role. What I can say is that when I talk to geneticists about this, people who do functional genetics and worry about what the actual genes do, and ask, are there reasons to think that these populations differ in a way that would be that would fundamentally affect their physiology so that it's not an apples-to-apples comparison? And they say, well, we don't know, but nothing jumps out. There's no sort of sickle cell anemia trait that is like, oh, bang, that's why they metabolize that way. But I think that what we're going to find is, what I hope we find is, as the genetics and genomics gets cheaper and easier, that we'll find not just why these populations differ, because surely that is part of the puzzle, but I actually am curious to know why they're all so similar. I mean, the similarity is the shocking thing to me. And, you know, genetically, human populations are mostly similar. So that makes sense. But, I'd love if the more we know about the genetics, obviously we're going to learn more about this. I think it's the next place to look. One of the next places to look. Yes, sir.
I just wanted to follow up on Bill's question.
Yeah.
Variability.
Yeah.
There's sort of two data sets, us and Hosmer. So, what about, what are the implications of Arctic equatorial types?
Mm-hmm.
Some wider range of variability.
Yeah. One of the, I don't know, because I don't have the data, and I'd love to know. I know that so that data set I showed you that was, instead of being each data point is an individual, but each data point is a global population spread all over the globe, that with the populations that are alive today might be the closest we're going to get to answering that question. And there, you know, the person those data, that's 98 populations global sample. Obviously, that wasn't my work; that's published work. And the woman who led that meta study did it to ask the question: if I split my data up among, you know, socioeconomic development scores, can I see an effect of that? As a rough way of asking about lifestyle, no effect. If I look at this across equatorial versus Arctic, nothing jumps out. We might just not have the grain of data to be able to ask that question with a lot of power. Sadly, we don't have a lot of Arctic groups that are still, and again, please let me know what to use, but that are traditional, that are doing traditional. Yeah. That don't shop at a supermarket, or that don't have farmed food that they buy with money. You know, that they're actually out there working for their own food. there's a possibility of doing some of that work in Greenland, I'm told. So maybe in a year or two, I'll be able to tell you something else. But right now, yeah.
Although what I've been trying to get Herman to focus on is if you looked at what one of his charts, he had the farmers marked.
Mm.
And the female farmers fell quite a bit above the normal female line. The male farmers fell quite a bit above the male line. And I think there might be something out there if you're living a horticultural lifestyle.
That's, yeah. Yeah, and we have data now for the Chimani horticulturalists, who are a group that live who practice sort of hand, and you know, they don't have machines, they have hand tools to do their agriculture and horticulture, and we have their data back as well, so we'll have that to look at. I think you're right that the elevation that you see in farming groups above the rest of us is still muted compared to what you'd expect for their activity levels, but it's possible that it's certainly there. So that's another thing to look at. Yeah.
Enjoyed your talk. So medium brain is a hypersensitive drug.
Yeah.
Performance. Lots of fatalities, like general diseases,
yeah,
associated with some sort of complex emotion. Why do you use this ability? I know that some organisms like goldfish.
Mm-hmm.
And it can do exactly the same thing in animals with some exceptions. And that allows them to survive long periods of time.
So you're asking why did mammals lose the reptilian brain protection that keeps you from dying when you don't have enough oxygen in your blood?
And everything shuts down. Mm. This is my colleague Peter Leeds.
Yeah.
So everything gets shut down.
Mm.
The channel of polarization.
The short answer is I don't know, but in evolution generally, you don't always get what you want. You can't get something for free. And what you're talking about is a difference. That's a difference between mammals and reptiles. So that's an evolutionarily very deep difference. It wouldn't be specific to humans. I don't know.
The thing mammals do, they become, they exhaust the limited supplies of the turtles shut down.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have the mammalian diving reflex, right? When kids fall through the ice in Lake Michigan and they haul them out 2 hours later and they're blue and they're not brain damaged or brain dead. Their body can still do some of that. It has to be very cold as well as being very anoxic. But the physiology it is what you're talking about. It's a shutdown because they don't produce all these metabolites that would really be damaging. So they've stopped the presses. The physiology of that I'm not an expert on, so I won't speak to it. How does waste fit into the equation? So I'm measuring energy expenditures, and so you take a bunch of food, you put it in your face, goes down here, your body sucks energy out of that and burns it. It doesn't suck all of it out, which is why we have the bathrooms located over here, right? If you were to measure the calories that came in to your mouth and subtract from that the energy that your body burned, you'd have a difference of about 10%. So for every 100 calories that you eat, your body gets 90 of those, 10% waste. And that's relatively similar across different... There isn't a whole lot of difference there across species. One of the big things that affects that difference, as far as I understand it, is how much fiber you eat, because of that fiber binds to a lot of the nutrients and pushes it through before your body gets a chance to eat it. Also, if you eat things... And also, you can't digest fiber very well if you're a human and with our simple guts, so you lose energy that way that potentially you could have absorbed out of the food. I don't know if that answers your question. That's... Yes.
I had a question about, so right now, given your data, you can hypothesize that there's not a large cultural difference, you know, between rate of burning calories. But is there data on, you know, adaptation to diet in particular locales? So if you change the humans in this particular ecosystem and have them eating something else where they can't metabolize?
Yeah. There's a couple of really nice examples of that. One is lactase persistence. So we can all digest milk when we're born, but most, if you are from a farming culture, in Northern Europe and in East Africa, the ability to keep that gene on and produce that enzyme throughout your whole adult life and digest milk your whole adult life, there's been a mutation there that allows that to happen. And so people who can trace their ancestry back to those locations tend to have a higher prevalence of lactose tolerance.
It's not about weight as much as sort of you can't digest. It's not so much about obesity.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I don't know about local adaptations. I mean, people argue that obesity is really prevalent in Micronesia, and that potentially is because you want to, I mean, the adaptive story that's not really been tested is that you want to have a good layer of subcutaneous fat because it's really cold and very humid and cold in those environments. Is that what you're talking about? I don't know.
I mean, given if you move to an environment where rice is the staple, that's been sort of,
So starch, actually, local populations have also adapted how much starch they eat. That's another nice example of genetic evolution underlying intake differences. So people who eat a lot of starch tend to have they carry more of the genes, repeated identical copies of the genes that make the stuff in your spit that digests starch, called salivary amylase. And the more of those genes you have kicking out that enzyme, the more starch you can break down. And so in populations like Asian populations that eat lots of rice, populations in Africa that eat a huge amount of their calories from starchy staples like tubers, they have high salivary amylase gene counts. So there's some evidence for that kind of stuff. Yeah. Yes.
I'm an amateur, so
we're all amateurs at heart.
Oh, we're talking about the brain.
Ah.
It seems to me that because you're saying these primitive cultures,
you definitely can't say primitive. You're not supposed to say traditional, but I know for sure you cannot say primitive.
Society, as opposed to women of society, you're saying that the women you described the metabolism and so on. Let's speak to this country where there are so many toxins in the food and in the soil that grows the food, the GMOs, the air, and the poor population. And, you know, for $3 a day, the poverty people live in poverty level, what I can buy as opposed to what the $3 a day will buy. So we're changing physical structure, that's why there's so much obesity, and where ultimately, I presume this change is much slower, we're changing brain structure.
I'm going to stop you there. There's no evidence that we're changing brains.
No, that's my whole point.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that it seems to me that the consequences of this kind of inequality are going to be enormous.
Well, I guess it's possible.
You and I are never going to see it because we're talking about on an evolutionary scale.
That's true.
So that I don't know.
Is this the road to ruin is what you're asking? Or I don't, is that what you're asking?
Yeah, go with that.
Yeah. Potentially, sure. You know, there's actually some nice data from the Framingham Heart Study. It's a big study, follows thousands of nurses. And you can see, people have argued, like Stephen Stearns has argued, that you can actually see sort of microevolution happening to deal with our horrible diets, and that people who don't handle sugar-rich, chemical-rich diets well are dying off, and the people who do handle them well are doing better. So that just supports your point that if you have this kind of environment long enough, you could actually affect what's going on. Predictions fun but messy and hard to do. So and people have been arguing that, you know, we're on the road to ruin for a long time. Thankfully, they're usually wrong. So I hope that...
Have you ever done brain imaging on people?
No. Nope. I haven't. I don't think for this particular measurements, but it'd be interesting.
Okay, who wants to have the last word? Well, but one more question.
Yes.
Just a quick question. You're talking about your double data, so we're exhaling CO2.
Yeah.
And we're urinating.
That's right.
And that's how you get the samples.
Basically.
All those different primates, and of course, including humans. How do you take into account sweat? Because humans sweat, the other primates don't. So does that affect the results?
Yeah, you have to. Actually, the bigger water loss, even just for humans, is the fact that you breathe out humid air all the time. So you're breathing when you know that you can fog up a mirror, right? So you're breathing water out that way too. So the short answer is yes. All of that stuff gets factored in. It has to, or else we'd be in trouble. Yep. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. It was really fun.
Hey.